To John chapter 12, the first few verses, John 12, verses 1 through 8. Turn to it. It's the Gospel of John, and you'll recognize it right away as familiar ground. Because it's not a long text, I'm going to read it. Wherefore Jesus, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, whom he had raised from the dead. They made there for him a feast, and Martha was serving. And Lazarus was one of those there, reclining at table with him. And Mary, taking a pound of scented oil, nard, genuine, very valuable, anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped with her hair his feet. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the scented oil. And Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, and then John tells us the one who was about to betray him, said, "Why was this myrrh not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" And then John editorially tells us, he said this not because there was in him any concern for the poor, but because he was a thief. And having the money purse, used to take out, carry off that which had been cast into it. Wherefore Jesus said, "Leave her alone, for in order that unto the day of my burial she has kept this thing," she has observed this. "The poor you always have with you, but me you do not always have." Now, this account is also recorded in Matthew chapter 26 and in Mark chapter 14. John wrote his gospel late, and John knew that everyone had already read Matthew's account of this event. And so he focuses on certain things, and I'll tell you why as we go through it, leaving other details out because they were readily available. Now, as best as we can reconstruct the chronology, and we'll follow John's chronology, this was the evening before the triumphal entry. Now, I point that out because we must understand it to see the high drama of this occasion, this event about which John leaves us a record. Did you ever see the movie High Noon? Sure you did, an old classic, Gary Cooper. It's Main Street at high noon, and everybody knows that something's going to happen because it's a showdown. Well, in a sense, it was high noon in Jerusalem. You see, Jesus had come out of the back country. He'd come down into the populated area, come into the environs of Jerusalem, and he had been saying to his disciples, "I'm going to go to Jerusalem, and they're going to kill me. I'm going to die." Very important to know that, to understand this text. "I'm going to die." And they were saying, "Well, you sure will if you go there," because the temple crowd, chief priests, who were represented the viewpoint of Jewish national religion and the primary Jewish opposition to Jesus, they had said, "If he shows up again, we're going to kill him." And so I can summarize the tension that's created by the tremendous crowds that were there for the Passover. Josephus gives the number in millions, and I think that's probably an exaggeration, but there was a crowd there during the Passover. And the rumors were going around, and rumors had spread that Jesus of Nazareth was coming. And so, and here's the phrase with which I would summarize the occasion. Everybody knew that something was going to happen, because it had to. But nobody was sure what was going to happen. Did you get that? When the irresistible force met the immovable object, something had to give. And so that's tomorrow. But this is the night before. And here we find Jesus in Bethany, and there the tension was the greatest. Because here he had just raised Lazarus. And this was Very important to know. Now, that's why John tells us that Lazarus was at the feast. He was one of those reclining at table. And I'll come back to Lazarus in just as we continue through the text. And so the tension is great. But that's tomorrow, and this is tonight. The night before, the day after. And Jesus, who is the Son of God, is also the Son of Man. And we see him doing something a man would do, something I would do and you would do. Before the trouble begins, you gather together with your friends for a last quiet time. These are the insiders. No enemies here except Judas. And he is having a feast. It's in the house. We know from looking at the other accounts, and I'll refer to them without taking time to read them. From the other accounts, we know that it was in the house of a man called Simon the leper. That's all we know about him. He's one of these magnificent characters who has a bit part, but a very important part in the drama of biblical literature. Lepers, as you may or may not know, were not isolated in caves like they were in the movie Ben-Hur. They had to observe certain rules of separation, certain procedures, but they stayed in their homes and carried on life in a fairly normal way, depending on the kind of leprosy they had and the progression of the disease. And this was a rich man, apparently, because he had a large house. Before, you see, when Jesus had a meal like this in Bethany, now Bethany was over the Mount of Olives to the east, just a nice walk. But when they had been there before, they had met in the house of Mary and Martha and Lazarus, this brother-sister family. But they're not there now. They're in the house of Simon the leper. I've got a guess, and it's just a guess, one of the reasons that may have been present for them not meeting in the house of Mary and Martha and Lazarus was because Lazarus was the focus of such animosity. We'll look at that in just a moment. In any case, here they are. Now I want to tell you two more things about this event, so you can picture it in your minds, and I'm not just trying to entertain you. You'll see as we go on, there's a reason for this. First of all, I'd like for you to see the feast there. Now, when you picture ancient feasts, ever since Leonardo da Vinci painted his famous Last Supper scene, nobody in the Western world, Western Christendom, has been able to get that image out of their mind for the Last Supper. I must have seen in my lifetime 5,000 different variations on Da Vinci's Last Supper. There they are on one side of the table. And that's not how they ate feasts in the ancient world. The reason they look that way in the picture is Da Vinci would do nothing of ancient history. And he didn't know any other way to get them all in the picture. So he put them all on the same side. It's like a photographer saying, look, fellas, you want to get in the picture, you're going to get on that side of the table. And so he painted them that way. But the way they actually did it was they set at three tables at a feast like this. They called it a triclinium. You can hear the word tri, or word triangle. It's a prefix meaning three. It was three-sided, made up of three tables in a squared-off horseshoe. Can you picture it? And the clinium, we get our word recline, because they did not sit in chairs, and most of you know this. They reclined on couches perpendicular to the tables. Yeah. So here's the tables, and those serving would circulate on the inside of the picture is a squared off horseshoe, a table here, and a table here, with the couches perpendicular to the table. Those serving would circulate on the inside of the table. Those washing the feet of the guests would circulate around the outside, and you could, if you're reclining on the couch, as you know, you can have your feet washed and eat at the same time, and that's exactly what they did. I was glad I learned that, because when I read some of the accounts, or heard some of the accounts as a little boy, I had a picture of Mary under the table washing Jesus' feet. It didn't look very dignified to me, and I'm glad to know it wasn't like that. And the chief seat, the seat of honor, at this, now here in the Western world, if we were arranging that, we would have put the seat of honor here, at this end, right? Like at a banquet, or being at a banquet, this is the seat of honor. But in the ancient world, and I don't have the foggiest notion why, the chief seat was the second seat from the end on this side. The second seat from, that's where Jesus sat at the Last Supper. The seats of honor, for the honored guests, those at the right and left hand, were on either side of him, making it the end seat on this side and the third seat. Got that? The end seat and the third seat were the seats of honor, that is to the honored, those that the master of the feast would honor. The master himself, in this case Jesus, sat and the second from the end. They would lean on their left hand, left elbow, to eat with the right hand. And by the way, and this isn't going to cost you anything, unless you want to come to Florida Christian and pay some tuition, I'll teach you thoroughly. We know from the deductions made in the text at the Last Supper, Jesus with his disciples, John had his normal seat at the far end. There was Jesus. Judas took Peter's seat, right in the third seat. Peter got mad and sat on this end. He took Judas' seat. He asked me later how I know that, but since I'm a college professor, you know it's true. Well, here they are. One more thing, and then to help us understand this, that when at a major feast, there was the guest, the master of the house, owed his guest three courtesies. First, in most cases, and especially in the cases of weddings or festive occasions, they would owe them a robe. They loaned them a robe. There were two reasons for this. Poor relatives came, and they would be embarrassed to sit in rags with the richer relatives, and so that was considered impolite. So everyone received a robe, so they looked the same. Secondly, second reason for this, people would get dirty traveling. They were dusty traveling in those days, so they would have a fresh robe. Second thing, the courtesy that they would extend is they would pour oil on the head. They would use olive oil from about the fourth or fifth squeezings. You couldn't cook with it, and couldn't burn it. And they would just to clean the hair. They would put oil on the hair. It works very well. You can try it sometime. Put oil on the head, and then you comb it, brush it out, and the dirt comes with it, leaving you clean, oily hair. So you're laughing because in recent days, in our generation, oily hair has become the unpardonable sin. But it was not so in the ancient world. And we know this, and Matthew tells us that this was that Mary poured the oil on Jesus' head as well as his feet. John tells us only about the feet. The third courtesy that was owed to people was the washing of the feet with water, usually done by the lowest servants in the house. And this is why it's particularly significant when Jesus, at the Last Supper, when they were using a borrowed or rented facility, there was no low slave in the house, bottom of the totem pole, and they're all looking at each other and saying, okay, who's going to admit that they're the least of the apostles and wash feet? And who does wash their feet? Jesus himself. And the reason he came to Peter first was because Peter had thrown a fit and was down that end of the table. That's where you started. Okay, well, we have here at this feast, this night, this tension-filled evening. Can you picture it in your minds, at least to some degree? Well, hope you can feel the tension as well. And we see in the events there the three competing views about Jesus in a microcosm. And that's why I like to teach on this text. First of all, we see Judas. Judas represents the view of Jesus that I would call utter rejection. He had made up his mind that the claims of Jesus were worth nothing. He was not the Son of God. He was already arranging for the betrayal of Jesus. Might as well make some cash out of it so that the last 3 years wouldn't have been a total loss. And so, and here is Judas. Now, with little doubt, Lazarus was sitting on this side of the table. I can't prove it, so it's a good thing I'm right about it. Lazarus would have been over here. And, and this is one of the reasons I believe that the gospel narratives, not the main reason, certainly, but one of the many reasons that I believe that the gospel narratives are inspired is just details just like this. I mean, if men had been writing this, the chief figure, at least a competing figure at this feast, would have been Lazarus. I mean, can you imagine going to a feast and one of the guests there is a fellow who was dead 4 days and just came back? I mean, there would be some jostling to sit next to him. Wouldn't you like to know what he had to say? Yeah. Where you been lately, Lazarus? How you feeling? Well, Lazarus, as far as we know, was told nothing about what he saw during his 4 days in the grave. I'm not surprised at that. Paul, writing to the Corinthians, said he knew a man 14 years ago, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know, was caught up into the third heaven. Probably, most likely referring to the fact that to the time when he was stoned to death at Derby on his first missionary tour. And he says he saw things not lawful for a man to speak. Well, Paul could not say what he saw.
And Lazarus apparently couldn't. Ellen White told what she saw, and we got the Seventh-day Adventist, but she was an exception. Forget I said that. But note this, Lazarus, there sits Lazarus. Now, you see, when Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, this was the last chance for the unbeliever. Judas' last chance, the Jews' last chance, the high priest, chief priest's last chance. I mean, this was the most spectacular of all of his miracles, with the exception of his own resurrection. Would you agree to that? The most spectacular. When does he perform it? Right at the end. Where does he perform it? In Bethany, just outside Jerusalem. I mean, the word was all over the place. If anybody was going to believe, this was going to do it. And if they were not going to believe, this was going to be their last chance. And this was Judas' last chance. And here sits Judas across the table from Lazarus. Can you imagine Judas, who's already making his plans to betray Jesus, looking square in the eye of the clearest evidence that he, Judas, is wrong and that the claims of Jesus are clearly substantiated? This shows the nature of unbelief, utter rejection. We look on down at the text. If we continue, verses 9 and following, it said, the crowds, the great crowds of the Jews, knowing that he was there, that is, Jesus was there, they came not only because Jesus was there, but also because but also that they might see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. The chief priests were taking counsel, making plans, how they might kill Lazarus. Poor guy, been killed once or dead once. They're going to do him in again. They're going to give him another funeral right away. And because many of the Jews were going away from the chief priests, leaving them, and were believing in Jesus. That is, Lazarus was a drawing card. People were gathering around the streets, probably looking in the windows, because not only because Jesus was there and because of the great tension that was created by his very presence, but because Lazarus was there. And look at the chief priests. They're plotting how to kill Lazarus. And Judas is of a mind with them. Got that? This is Judas' friends now, the chief priests. Now think about that. Here's Lazarus. It's time to decide about Jesus. And they're trying to get rid of the evidence. That's the nature of unbelief. I've studied faith by believers, and I've studied unbelief by non-believers. And I have noticed a pattern among intellectual, academic non-believers. They love to get rid of the evidence. It doesn't matter what the evidence is, they're not going to believe. You understand? I mean, can you imagine that? Here's Lazarus, 4 days out of the grave, and the response is, let's kill him again. Utter rejection. Let me tell you that there is nothing intellectual about unbelief. It is emotional and spiritual. What you have to believe to be an unbeliever is unbelievable. And the way you have to close your mind if you're not going to accept the claims of Jesus of Nazareth is astounding. And what Judas did was astounding. Utter rejection. You see, I think this is why, and again, I can't prove this. Mary comes in. Remember the three courtesies? The robe, the hair, and the feet. And Mary comes in, and she puts this very expensive ointment. John multiplies adjectives to tell us just how expensive this was. It was a pound, a Roman pound, about 8 ounces, which was quite a bit, of scented oil, perfume, nard, genuine, of great value. Nard, genuine, of great value. It's interesting, Judas put a price on it. Judas is a man, like so many men of our age, who know the value of nothing but the price of everything. And he put a price on it, almost a year's wages, 300 denarii. A denarii was a day's wage. So if you figure working days, about a year's wages. And here you can see Judas, who's a thief, John tells us. And Mary comes in while Jesus is talking, and he takes this, and we know that it's an alabaster jar. And we're told that by the other gospel writers. Now, alabaster was, the fact that it was in alabaster is significant. Alabaster was very thick, not porous, and they would put materials in it that they wanted to keep for long periods of time because it would not soak into or through the walls. It was what you kept, something you wanted to keep.
It's where you kept it. I recall last time I was in the British, the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, seeing the tall alabaster containers of perfume taken from the tomb of Tutankhamun. And the experts say that the liquid was gone after over 2,000 years, but you could still smell it. And she brings this in and breaks it. Can you picture it? She anoints the head of Jesus with that oil. Understand? Very expensive. Normally you use the cheapest olive oil, and here she's using this expensive myrrh. And Judas about chokes on that, but he doesn't say a word. When does Judas erupt? He erupts when she puts it on his feet. You're supposed to use water for that. The water you can't even drink, that's what you put on your feet. And that was more than Judas could take. And that's why John, I think, tells us, doesn't mention the pouring on the head, that this is what set Judas off. It's okay to put on his head if you're going to do that, but not his feet. And that was too much. That was a straw that broke the camel's back, and Judas said, "Why this waste?" That's how Matthew records it. Why this waste? And then he tries to make it respectable. Well, we could have sold this for a year's wages and given it to the poor. And then John reminds us that Judas didn't care one thing about the poor people. He hated Jesus. Think about this. He hated Jesus. He's making a deal for 30 pieces of silver, and here's Mary putting more on his feet than he's going to get for selling it. But you see, there's a certain logic to Judas' position. Now, I don't want to take the role of one defending Judas, but let me say that if Judas was right about Jesus, that he is not the Son of God, then Judas was right. It was a waste. Would you disagree with that? And if Judas was right that Jesus was an imposter, then the act of Judas in plotting for his betrayal was a reasonable, logical, moral thing to do. You see, the law of Moses provided the death penalty for a blasphemer, right? The Romans had taken the death penalty away from the Jews, so the best thing that Judas could do to put this blasphemer to death was to arrange for him to be put to death. That is, what Judas did in betraying Jesus was in the spirit, if not the letter, of the Mosaic law. If he was right about Jesus. And if he was right, Jesus was a blasphemer. And it was a waste. But you see, if Judas was right, if they had brought the dirty dishwater from the kitchen and put it on the feet of Jesus, that would have been a waste. It didn't matter. Anything given to Jesus is a waste, if Judas is right. What we're doing here is a waste. A lot of people think we're wasting our time this morning, don't they? You probably got relatives and family think, well, you're going to church. What a waste. You ever been told that? What a waste. This building, what a waste. Well, they're right if Judas was right. Then we come to Mary. And here we see utter devotion. I've already talked about what she did. It's interesting. Mary got the message. I hate to admit this. You recall that Jesus had been teaching his disciples, I'm going to go die. But they were hanging on to this Jewish nationalistic, physical, imperial expectation. They wanted a worldly kingdom, and they were resisting. Two of them we know. One of them was Peter. We don't know who the other one was. They're still carrying a sword. They're still resisting. They still had not figured out how his plans to die fit into the Messianic kingdom. And they were resisting it, and they were ready to fight. But Mary seems to, more than the rest, I don't know what she understood, but it's very clear to me that she understood more than Peter and James and John did. Women often do that. Jesus had been saying, I'm going to die. They're saying, oh no. And she anoints him for his burial. She knows he's about gone. This is an impulse of love. She knows this will be the last time she'll have a chance to do this. And so she gets, it may have been her inheritance. The most valuable thing she had. And she puts it on his head, on his feet. And Jesus said, leave her alone. I'm going to be buried. And she knows it. She's preparing me for my burial. Women often get the message when men don't. Isn't that something? Jesus had been with the 12 for 3.5 years. And Mary was ahead of him on this. Now, utter devotion. The appropriateness of her offering. Now, see, you and I can look back and we can say, oh, that's right. That was just the right thing to do. You couldn't have dreamed up a better gesture. If I could go back in some kind of time machine and wangle an invitation to this feast, I'd do something like that. You see, but now we know. But see, she did it then, before the fact. It's appropriate. Was it a waste? I think not. You see, in the case of Judas, as I said, if they had taken the dirty dishwater and washed his feet, even that would have been a waste. But if Mary could have, in some mystical, hypothetical way, reached out into the whole universe and gathered into that alabaster jar all the mineral wealth of the universe, and having it in that jar, break it and put it on his feet, it still would not have been a waste. Understand? What she gave, 10 times what she gave, a million times what she gave, it would never have been a waste. Why? Because Mary was right. And if she was right, it wasn't a waste. It all depends on how you look at it. What she did was logical. You understand? What Judas did was logical from his point of view. And what Mary did was logical from her point of view. What a waste. Now, every year at Florida Christian College, about September, I get angry. I'm usually mad to the middle of October. It takes that long to get over it. I used to call it righteous indignation, but it isn't. I'm just mad. You know, I get mad. We have walking on our campus some of the finest young people that God ever made. And I know the situation they came from. And some of them, because they are highly talented and seem to have a lot of ability, when they walk on our campus, somebody has said to them, sometimes it's a well-meaning high school counselor. Sometimes it's a parent. Sometimes, God help them, it's an elder in the church who has said to that young person, oh, you're not going to Bible college, are you? Why, with your abilities, you could, and then fill in the blank, you could become a profession, you could make a lot of money, and what they're saying, you're not going to waste your life, are you, at Bible college? That's why I get mad. What a waste. What's going to waste it? Well, I want you to know those young people who come and study at our college or any other Bible college, they're not wasting their lives. Why? Because Judas was wrong and Mary was right. Not a waste. A lot of people think any part of the Christian life is a waste. It's interesting. This is ironic. The world is really stupid, you know. And it's a fatal kind of stupidity. You realize there are people this morning who think you're wasting your time here? People who are giving their lives to pornography and materialism and alcohol, who have put in 30 or 40 or 50 years and have a thing to show for it, except a few material things, some not that. Their life doesn't amount to a hill of beans. They've thrown everything away in a piece of foolishness, and they think we're wasting our lives. Martha was serving, John tells us. And Martha was serving. And the word there for serving means the common service. Mary was on the outside of the table, and Martha was on the inside. Well, we saw her there before, didn't we? You recall in the earlier feast, at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, at her own house, she's in the kitchen fixing the meal, and Mary's at the feet of Jesus, and she sends word out, said, Master, tell Mary to come and help me in the kitchen. And Jesus said the same thing he says here, leave her alone. In that case, he said, she has chosen the better part. This time, Martha has learned. She doesn't say a word. Mary is anointing the feet. We find Mary where she was before, at the feet of Jesus, and we find Martha where she was before, in the kitchen. Kipling, one of my favorite authors, wrote a poem in 1907 called The Sons of Martha. And the first and last verses go like this. The sons of Mary seldom bother, for they have inherited that good part. But the sons of Martha favor their mother and the careful soul of the careful soul and the troubled heart. And because she lost her temper once, and because she was rude to the Lord, her guest, her sons must wait upon Mary's sons, world without end, reprieve or rest. And the sons of Mary smile and are blessed. They know the angels are on their side. They know in them is the grace confessed, and for them are the mercies multiplied. They sit at the feet, they hear the word, they see how truly the promise runs. They have cast their burden upon the Lord, and the Lord, he lays it on Martha's sons.
Well, Kipling was kind of an agnostic fella, and I think he was wrong about that. You see, Martha was serving with the same utter devotion that Mary was, really. There's more than one way to serve the Lord. You can serve on the outside of the table or on the inside. Now, let's not put Mary down. You see, it was a feast after all, wasn't it? Was it not? It was a meal. Unless you got somebody in the kitchen, you can have all the teaching in the world, but you don't have to, it doesn't make it a feast. I spend, if we're going to think in terms of the sons of Martha and the sons of Mary, I spend every week during the school year in the classrooms at FCC teaching the sons of Mary. Every other Tuesday, which is payday, I thank God for the sons of Martha. If it weren't for the sons of Martha, I could not teach the sons of Mary. And what the sons of Martha do is just as important as what we do in teaching the sons of Mary. Now, as a matter of fact, most of us, we spend some of our time on the inside of the table and some on the out, don't we? Sometimes we're the sons of Martha, at other times we're the sons of Mary. But whether we are serving as Martha or Mary, it is utter devotion, and that makes sense. I'm just about finished. To come to the third view, I call this moderate devotion. It's the disciples. Here's Judas acting with perfect reason, is he not? What a waste. Here's Mary acting with perfect reason, anointing the feet of Jesus. And here's the disciples. Now, Judas gets a bad rap here. If you look at all three accounts, he said, and of course John knew that the people who knew that had read these accounts, Judas says, why this waste? And the disciples joined him and said, yeah, now that you mention it, why this waste? They said the same thing Judas said. It's kind of like Thomas. Thomas has come down in church history as doubting Thomas, which is completely unfair to Thomas. Thomas doubted when the disciples told him that Jesus had risen from the dead. But if you'll read the account, the disciples doubted when the women told them. They said the same thing that Thomas said. Well, they said, these disciples here said the same thing that Judas said. He sang the verse and they joined him on the chorus. Yeah, why this waste? Now, they didn't do it because they agreed with him. They did it because they were caught up in the moment. There was no logic to their position. But they represented at this time, moderate devotion. That is, they, you understand? They agreed with Mary, but they joined Judas. Their faith in him was just as great as the faith of Mary. They certainly were not going to betray him, but they joined Judas. Now think about that. And said, yeah, we could have sold this for a lot of money and given it to the poor. It is a waste. Now, the disciples, I'll just say this to make this thought. The disciples learned better later, didn't they? They came to the place where they really understood, and they gave their lives in acts of utter devotion. But at this time, they're confused. And there's no logic to their position. Understand? They're neither Judas nor Mary. You see, if he is what Judas says, then they're wrong about him. But if Mary's right, it's not a waste. Moderate devotion. A little, but not too much. It's okay to honor Jesus, but let's not be silly about it. Let's be practical. God save us from the practical men when they have their say too much. Too much practicality can kill somebody. I know families that have fallen apart because the father was practical. They're practical. But what I'm trying to say, not saying it very well, is this, that in our day, we've either got to stand with Judas or stand with Mary. We cannot stand where the disciples stood on that evening because moderate devotion isn't going to do it anymore. Yes, we love him, we believe in him, but let's not waste anything on him. Be careful how much we give him. One of the most discouraging things about the kind of ministry I'm in now is that so many students, they want to do the minimum to get by. Kind of like all the churches they came from. Do the minimum to get by. Faith, but not too much devotion, not too much service, not too much study. I'm very critical of the professional clergy, and I'm a part of it in some ways. Because we have believers who serve Jesus with a moderate kind of civilized devotion.
which gives us materialistic churches and social clubs, hall churches. Jesus, yes, but real devotion, not too much. Just enough to sort of keep our franchise, not enough to offend the community. Put something on his feet, but not the alabaster jar. That's too much. And let me say this to you, especially to the young people. The day is past, and the church can get by with moderate devotion. The church will die with moderate devotion because a new kind of paganism has become our culture, and our culture has become this new kind of paganism which will kill the church that is moderately devoted to Christ. And so we learn better. Well, you've been very patient. Utter rejection, Judas. Utter devotion, Mary. Moderate devotion, that's the one view that will not make sense. Either hating or loving. But let's have none of this nonsense of Jesus being a good teacher and a good man to whom some is owed, something is owed, but not too much. What a waste. What a waste. I may close by telling you a story. It's a true story. I think years ago, Isabel Diddemore has spoken at this church. Is that not true, Isabel Diddemore? You know the story of Isabel? Some of you do. Isabel's my wife's aunt. She's been a widow since the 1940s. And a missionary, she's a retired missionary now. Isabel married Warren Diddemore. Warren was a fine young man, a man of high ability, excellent, very keen mind. Could have been anything, as people like to say. And back in the late 30s, he heard Dr. Shelton who had come back from the Tibetan border of China. He'd come back and he had asked for missionaries to go help him. And at that time, it still is, a very remote, dangerous part of the world. And so Warren Diddemore said he would go. Dr. Shelton returned to China to be murdered by mountain bandits. And that intensified the determination of Warren Diddemore, a very brilliant young man, to go to the mission field. So he began to study. He prepared himself with a good Bible education, 4 or 5 years. Second World War began, and he could not get into China, but he was going anyway sometime, so he continued to prepare. He got a medical education, what we would today call a paramedical education, because he would be the only medical service that they had in that backcountry. And then he prepared himself with an agricultural or horticultural education so he could help them in that area. A very well-trained man, went to school about 7 or 8 years. Intensive education. Then the war was over, and he with his wife, Isabel, and their daughter, Janet, they entered China. As far as we know, she was the first white child to enter China after the Second World War. Made the long journey of several weeks just to get there, and he set up his mission work and began to preach. But in the first year, he caught typhoid fever and died. There about 7 months. His own wife couldn't take care of him because his disease was contagious and he had the baby. Dorothy Sterling nursed him during his last days of life. His wife, Isabel, lined his coffin with her wedding dress. They buried him. Not too many years after that, they had to leave that country because of the communist revolution, and they had to take the marker off of his grave, because the communists would have dug it up and desecrated it, because the presence of that headstone was a tremendous Christian witness to the peoples there. Just think of that, a brilliant young man, prepared 7 or 8 years and served 7 months. What a waste. What a waste. Think so? The world thinks so. I studied anthropology at the university. They think all mission work is a waste. They'll tell you that. You understand? If he'd have served for 40 years, it would have been a waste. You think it was a waste? You ought to ask his wife and see if she thinks it was a waste. Ask her. She's still around. She didn't think it was a waste. She thought it was just about right. Ask his daughter who grew up without a father if she thought it was a waste. No. She thought it was appropriate. Kind of like Mary's alabaster jar. You could have asked him, and they did, and he thought it was a grand gift for God that he could serve as long as he did and give up his life for Jesus. Warren didn't think it was a waste. Why? Because Mary was right and Judas was wrong. I wonder if Jesus thought it was a waste. I think Jesus could have said, leave him alone. What he's doing is just right. Just right. Now, if I haven't made that message clear now, I never will. We're going to sing an invitation to him. You've been very patient with me, and I thank you for that. And that there may need to be some decisions made of many kinds. Now listen clearly. This is the most important time of the message. If you're not a Christian, I invite you to come and break the alabaster jar of your life and put it at the feet of Jesus by obeying the gospel and giving him your life and wasting it on him. Christian, I think it's for you to say, not for me, I'm not your judge, I'm your teacher. It's for you to say whether you this day stand with Judas or Mary or the disciples. No other place to stand. You can reject him utterly or love him utterly. The thing you cannot do is give him moderate devotion. If you've been giving him moderate devotion, maybe, perhaps you need to walk the aisles to let us help you with this thing, or maybe you just need to make a decision that from now on, you're going to move with Mary into the ranks of those who serve him with utter devotion. Perhaps that's the decision you need to make. Do so while we stand together.